Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast. I'm Ben Eshmade, and on this week's edition, we focus on two consecutive films by British director Andrew Haig. We get insight from the director himself about his 2015 film 45 Years and a different perspective from lead actor Charlie Plummer on its follow-up, Lean on Pete.
For me, that's what happens in the film, is both of the characters focus in, their world loses its meaning.
I compare this film to an untraditional love story. To have a scene partner that, you know, has these beautiful, huge eyes and is so expressive and decides to do what he wants when he wants for a lot of the time.
We begin, though, with 45 Years, which stars Charlotte Rampling and Tom Courtney as couple Kate and Jeff, who we find happy and heading towards their 45th wedding anniversary. A letter arrives, forcing them to examine the foundation of their marriage and the relationship to this point.
What is it?
A letter.
Yes, I know, but from?
But I think it says they found her.
Found who?
I remember telling you, clear as day.
Of course I remember, I mean, it was a long time ago.
Yeah, and I know I told you about my Katya. She's been there over 50 years. Now something in the freezer. Now they've found her.
I'll make some more tea.
Andrew Haig is the director of the much-praised Weekend, as well as being responsible for the HBO series Looking, which we discuss in passing. I spoke to him over coffee in central London.
I thought I'd start. I like the fact that you've jumped from the exploration of love on a weekend to the exploration of a love over 45 years. That's quite a jump.
Yeah, I think I do kind of see the films as like companion pieces in many ways. Like, obviously, they're about very different relationships. But I do think there is a similarity between the two, or like... 45 years is, you know, an extension of things I was trying to look at in Weekend, and then looking at it within, you know, a long-term relationship felt really interesting to me. And so it's funny that there's definitely a similarity between the two films.
It's based on a short story, I believe. Where did you come across that, and then why did you decide to work with that?
Yeah, I came across it a long time ago now, probably while I was making Weekend, and I'd made a short film that was in a collection by this publisher, and this publisher sent me this short story, which was part of another collection, David's collection. I just really loved it. There was something so simple and like profound about the story. And it's a short story. And I knew that like to adapt it for the screen, it would need some expansion and it would need some kind of changes. But it kind of really felt that it got to the heart of the relationship, of this kind of long-standing relationship, of the way that the past can re-emerge and affect the present, how it can throw your life into kind of like a quiet kind of chaos all of a sudden when you least expect it. And I think that's what's really interesting. You go along in your life happily enough, and it doesn't take much for it all to kind of like shatter and fall apart. And what's so interesting about the story is that it's not really something that's like real anymore. It's something so long ago. It's like a ghost from the past that kind of affects the present. And that was interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of the event, the discovery of this former lover, it captured in ice, or, you know, frozen in ice, is extraordinary. But you also get the impression, as you're saying, that it doesn't matter what it is as such.
Yeah, I think that's true. It could be anything. I think that's the thing. It ends up not being a story about this woman in the ice. And, you know, and Jeff is not harking back to being madly in love with this woman either. It's just this thing about something that happened a long time ago, about youth and about a moment of vitality and all those kind of things, that has the power to affect affect the present. And I think that's, in other versions of this film, would all be about that mystery. It would all be about the body, and they would go to Switzerland and they would like dig it up and they would have a confrontation and all those kind of things. And I do remember thinking that in a more maybe traditional film, my film would be the first act and then it would continue on. But I like that kind of expansion of that. And I think you can end up getting kind of deeper into what that kind of means for their relationship when you kind of hone in a little bit.
There's something I want to tell you.
Okay, go on.
Yeah, I was her next of kin.
What do you mean?
Well, officially, I was her next of kin. I'm sure I told you this before.
But I think I remember her husband being another woman's next of kin. Why?
Why what?
Well, why were you her next of kin?
Because they thought we were married.
Who did?
The authorities, people.
What made them think that?
We told them we were.
You weren't, though?
Oh, no. Hell no, we just had to pretend so that people would let us stay in their houses. Different in those days, Kate, and then after the accident.
What I came out with was the idea that we experience this week in their life, and it's obviously a point of extreme change. But things, by the end, we've got to a point where it's kind of over and they're back to the people that we see at the beginning. I mean,
it's really interesting to me how people like interpret the end very differently. I think some people think that she's going to just get back into the normal life with him and it's going to be all right. For others, I think they think she'll never be the same again and everything has changed, but she'll stay with him. And then others think she's going to leave him. And that's interesting to me because I do think that it was always, I wanted the ending to have an element of openness to it so people can interpret it as they want. And I do think it actually sums up people's own personal philosophy of their own life and how they feel about, you know, relationships and what's important in their life in how they read that ending. And that to me is quite an interesting kind of thing to do.
It's definitely the case over the last few years that more films have been made about approaching the retirement, but it still feels like something that we just don't see enough of on screen.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I think some of the films that are about the kind of older experience are far more geared towards, like, you know, light, frothy films. And that wasn't interesting to me at all. You know, I think I approached the story almost not thinking of these people being old. Like, as I was writing it, it was like, I'm thinking, I want these people to think about things as I would, and I'm 42, or how, you know, even when you're in your 30s, you do. To me, it really is far more about, you know, what are the choices we make? How do those choices affect our lives? And if we, like, analyze those choices and we analyze what we've done with our life, how does that make us feel? And I think both characters have got to this point in the story where they're forced, because of this reveal, to really focus in on their lives. And that's a terrifying thing to do at any age, whether you're 15 or whether you're 70. You know, the more you focus in on something, the more it kind of falls apart and loses its meaning. And I think for me, that's what happens in the film, is both of the characters focus in, their world loses its meaning, and Jeff manages to kind of find his meaning back again and realize, this is a good marriage, I love my wife, this is fine. But for Kate, it's a harder thing to put back together again.
There is a sense as well that this home, which is like a castle built of memories and standards and ideals, and it's an important character in the film.
Absolutely, the house is essential. Like, I think especially when you do live in the same place for a long time, which these two characters have, they've built, the house reflects who they are. The books on the shelves, the music they listen to, everything reflects who they are as people. And that was really important to us, to get that house to feel like it's like a living, breathing character. And even in terms of like the sound design, you know, we made sure that it had its own like creaking sound, and the attic sounded a certain way, and the wind sounded a certain way in the windows. And I think, you know, when you live somewhere, it becomes like your refuge. And I think what's hard for say Kate in the film is suddenly that all starts to break down again. Like, she hasn't been up into that attic for years, and suddenly it's there, and it's like everything she knew, or everything she thought was true about her life, suddenly is just slightly altered. It's not even that it's radically different. It's just altered enough to throw her off into like a kind of existential kind of crisis.
As you mentioned it there, I mean, one thing I definitely wanted to mention was the sound design. I mean, what were your thoughts behind that?
Because I don't have any traditional score in the film, there's some music playing, but there's no like score. Sound design becomes so important. And the sound designer, Joachim Sundström, like, we talked a lot about trying to like really, it's about making it feel still realistic but expressive. So it's about finding that balance. So you're not like hyper aware of the sound design, but at the same time, it feels like it's like a character and it's telling you something that, you know, adding to the kind of visuals of the film. And, you know, the winds, I mean, the amount of winds that Joachim looked through. And there was this, like, sounds of glaciers, like, cracking. There's all these, like, very subtle things. And he's very good at, like, building up a subtle soundscape that, like, really kind of brings it all to life a little bit.
What was there any inspiration points for this?
I mean, my inspirations are kind of all over the place. They range from, you know, I don't know, there's so many films that kind of inspire me. But it's just, for me, it's always about, okay, how can I tell the most, like, truthful version of this story? And also try and, I'm a big, like, fan of keeping things simple. It doesn't mean you have to be dulled or boring with how you're shooting something, but it's about having a kind of simplicity that allows the actors to do their work, allows you to kind of, you have to work at the film a little bit. And I like that. I want the audience to have to, like, give it some effort and work at it, sit back and think, oh, this is fine. I need people to, like, work at it.
Trying to kind of understand your sort of technique when you're being a director. I mean, again, with this and with your last film, there's a sense of you. Do you let them live as those characters and then film around them a little bit, or are you very strict on the on following scripts?
I think it's this was a lot more like, I think Weekend there was more room for improvisation, the style of how the film was. This was much more just like script as it was. I don't like shot list or anything, but I do have a pretty firm idea of what I want it to be going into each day. And I'm usually quite clear on how I want things blocked. Like I like, because blocking becomes so important when you're shooting something without too many edits, which both Weekend and 45 Years is, it's very important that that each scene like builds on each other in terms of what angle you use. Like, so if you have one scene that's wider in scope, you know, you want, and you're not going to cut within it, then you want the next scene to be maybe closer, or you want the next scene after that to be a close-up. So I kind of build my film in sequences rather than in scenes. Okay. And use that as like a visual way to kind of slowly draw you in and then bring you back again and draw you in. I know talking to Tom, he was often very surprised how we would shoot a scene with one shot and then we'd be like, right, done, move on. And Tom would be like, okay, so where's my close-up? You know, and there's certain scenes where you don't even see Tom. He's like sitting behind a wall. You don't even see him. And then he comes around the corner. And I think that was sometimes quite surprising. But it's just how I like to do things. I don't do much coverage. I don't like to shoot things too many ways. It's like making a commitment to how you think a scene should be and then just keeping your fingers crossed that it works.
Yeah, it's been an odd day.
Sure has.
I just stayed at home, you know, grappling with a bald cock. But you're right. I hardly go walking anymore. It was a nice day, so off I went.
So where did you go?
Just to the village.
To buy cigarettes?
It feels like a slow film.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly like, I think it's interesting when you spend time with people who are that age, life is a little bit slower. They talk slower. Like people who are older just talk a little bit slower than people who are in their 20s. So Weekend, they're like talking really quickly and it has a more handheld vibe. It's a slower way of life. And I think it was important that was reflected in the visuals. Like it's like a calmer visual style. It's not, you know, it kind of slow is probably how you would say it, because their life has like continued along a way that's kind of bedded in and kind of, you know, set.
When things happen, they're quite subtle. So, for instance, like one moment of shockingness is when Jeff starts smoking. that's kind of like as scary as it gets.
I think it's true. It's like there's little subtle things, like, you know, oh, he started smoking. It's like, oh my goodness, something's happened. And I do like that, because I do think that is the truth of most people's lives. Like the things that happen in most people's lives are small, subtle things. And the fact that he started smoking again is actually very important for the story. Even though, you know, it's just him having a cigarette again. I'm well aware that, you know, that it's the film works on a certain level in terms of, you know, story-wise and plot-wise. And, you know, it's something that it's those small details that speak, you know, volumes about the world rather than big events.
I lost my sense of smell, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't want us to start smoking again.
I won't. Promise.
But of course, for me, cinema can be as simple as just like watching a close-up of someone's face. Do you know what I mean? And I find that conversation and between two people is often like thought of as being uncinematic. But of course, I don't think that's true. And I think you can understand so much more about a person through how they interact with someone else. And, you know, there's so many great films, I think, that are just based on. Like I watched, you know, My Dinner with Andre again recently, and it's two people sitting in a restaurant for an hour and a half talking. And it's fantastic.
I think Charlotte Rampling and Tom Courtney had worked together before. I mean, how much work did you have to do to kind of help them become those characters?
They actually hadn't worked together before. And it was really strange to me because you kind of think they should have done because of how long they've been working and stuff. And they hadn't worked together before. And they hadn't really, they'd met a couple of times, but that was it. So, I mean, we shot the film in order and we did like a read through. We didn't really do any rehearsals. Charlotte isn't a huge fan of rehearsals. And actually, I'm not a huge fan of rehearsing either. I feel like I want to just wait and see what happens on the day and see what happens. And so you're always, it's nerve-wracking casting. Like you don't know if someone's going to work together. You're like, oh God, is this going to work? And I feel like they're both so professional that they can make it work. Yeah. Like I do think in the end, chemistry is about good performance and about directing things a certain way. And that's what creates the chemistry in many ways. So whenever I see films and the chemistry just seems really off, to me, it's like, I just think there's somebody's done something wrong. It's not necessarily the actor's fault. So they were great together in just like creating this kind of life. And the weird thing is like the event happens very quickly into the film. Mm. So you really don't actually see their life happen much before this this event. So they did a great job at just kind of filling in the blanks, I think. I love this notion of the fact they hadn't had photos because they haven't got children. They just didn't take photos. Like I think if you have kids, you take more photos. It's simple. And it means that there's probably more photos of all of you around and there's more photos of your life growing old and there's like a wall of photos that people have. And these two haven't done it. And I think that was interesting in terms of this is a story about the two of them reflecting back on their life. They're losing the sense of what that was, you know, and they don't have photos around them to remind them. And I thought that was really interesting. And I do like the fact that you learn enough about them, but you don't learn everything about them. You don't know about how their marriage was for 45 years. You don't know what the conversation was around whether they should have children or not. Yeah. You don't know what the conversation was about moving to Norfolk. Like I know, or I came up with what I thought those conversations would be, you know, when I was like developing the script, but I didn't want to put them in the film. I feel like you need to have some kind of mystery in a film, so it enables the audience just to like put themselves in it to a greater degree. And yeah, that's always the kind of intention.
It's kind of, you know, playing on shared memories between people. I think the other thing as well is the party at the end. I think most people agree that these things can be quite hideous.
I think it's one of those where I'm convinced that Kate is like, what the hell am I doing here? Like, I do think there's a notion of it's a strange thing doing that kind of thing because you are celebrating something for other people. So you're celebrating a very personal relationship that nobody really understands. You barely understand it when you're in it, in that relationship. But you're celebrating something and you're showing everybody else what it is. And I think that's why it's so interesting within the film. It's like they're building up to this event where they are telling the world, this is who we are. This is what our relationship has. We love each other. We've been together 45 years. And of course, nobody at that party knows the truth of what's been happening and how that their relationship is on like fragile, uneven ground now. And I think that's like a really fascinating thing to me. And like, I would never have a party like that. And I barely want to have a birthday party. My idea of birthday parties is sitting watching like film in my bedroom, like with a beer. Like, I don't like seeing people because it's just that notion of celebrating what you've achieved with other people. It just feels a bit weird to me.
I was in the village and I don't know what happened, but that racist from the community centre...
Sandra Wilkins.
Yeah, her. She came up to me, right up to my face, and she kept asking me if I was all right. And when I said I was, she wouldn't believe me. I wasn't doing anything. Nothing, just sitting on the bench by the duck pond, minding my own business and getting some air.
Hold up.
All I was doing, promise.
I believe you. She's a dreadful woman. Just ignore her.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask, because it seems, again, going back to the large leaps, it's fascinating to know that you sort of worked early on in Gladiator and Black Hawk Down. I mean, is there anything that you took from those which is relevant to a film like this?
I would say 45 Years is almost identical to Black Hawk Down. It's just cups of tea and, like, watches rather than, like, guns and, like, explosions. It was, I mean, you know, I was an assistant editor on those films, so you're not creatively involved when you're an assistant editor. I think working in editing is actually a really good training ground because, you know, that is where often the story is made, is in that edit room. Like, you would think it probably shouldn't be, but often it does end up that you have to create that story within the edit room. My, like, desire to tell stories in a simpler way and visually simpler and less editing, basically, has been influenced by working on films which has so much cutting. Because I would work on a lot of those films and think, I don't feel the need to cut now. I'm like losing something and my brain is like being forced to like look around the screen constantly and I'm going through these like slight temporal jumps, all these kind of things, and I just want to let it exist and let the audience watch it, make up their own opinion and move on to the next thing.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Listen, I hope you don't mind. I just wanted to come in and apologize for last night.
For what?
Well, you know, I was a little drunk, and I hope that I didn't come across as...
As?
Well, as, you know, one of those guys that...
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine. I should have told you I was starting here before you went too far.
Thank you.
And was it interesting making the TV series with HBO? I mean, has that had an effect in some ways?
It's certainly been it's been a different experience. It's like, I mean, it's been great and I've really enjoyed it. It's like suddenly you're working instead of like my crews are very small on films, even 45 years, it's like 30 people. TV show, regardless of the scale of the TV show, you have like 200 people. So it's a bigger thing and the budgets are bigger and you have a lot of crew and a whole like kind of thing around it. But it's a different thing. There's different priorities. There's different voices that have to be listened to when you're making a TV show. There's, you know, it's a lot more expensive, so there are other priorities at stake. But I do enjoy it. Like, I think I like both. I think film is always where my heart is. Yeah. And even though a lot of people think, well, film and TV is the same thing nowadays, I personally don't think it is. I think TV is great. I think film is different. There are things in TV. It's interesting, you mentioned, we talked about sound design. On TV, you can't be as subtle with your sound design. There's limits. You can't be, you know, you can't go too loud and you can't go too quiet because of people's televisions. So there are things that are a little bit constrictive when you're making TV. But still, they have their its own, like, pleasures, definitely.
Well, I suppose the easiest way I could compare it is the fact that with a film like 45 Years, it's that unless you go into a cinema, you said for the next couple of hours, I'm going to watch this film, we just bombarded with so much in our lives that you can't concentrate.
I agree. Like, I always get, it makes me crazy when people get sent, like, the link to the film to watch. I'm like, no, you've got to sit in the cinema. Because it's true. Like, if you watch that on TV, I know when the TV show is on, you get people, like, tweeting while they're watching the show. And I go insane about it. I'm like, I want to reply to him. Why are you tweeting? Like, watch it, have an opinion. And it's people like, I love this bit. I hate this bit. This bit's awful. This bit's so boring, I'm turning off. This bit's fantastic. And it's like, it drives me insane. I mean, if it was up to me, an audience would be locked into a room, the door would be shut, they would be chained to their seat, and they'd be made to watch it. So, but I know the world doesn't work like that, unfortunately.
Last question, and maybe moving back again to the start. After making this and viewing it, should we leave the past alone is my question.
I think it's hard. I think you can't leave the past alone. I think the past obviously is the past. I'm a firm believer that everything that happens to us, you know, creates the person that we are. And whether we like it or not, that's the case. You know, we are a product of our experience and usually random experience, unfortunately. It's just about where you ended up being born, who your parents were, where you lived, what your schooling was like. Like, you can't escape those things. Sometimes it's incredibly unfair, and that's what's so awful about the world, really, is that people are born into, like, shit circumstances and awful things can happen to people. So I think it's very hard to not have the past affect you. I suppose it's about finding a way to deal with the stuff that's happened in your life and try to find a way forward and know that you do always have some element of control in trying to make it work better for you and be better for you.
I think I'm going to have a go upstairs and have a bath. I've got lots to do tomorrow.
Are you sure you're all right?
Yes. Yeah, really I am. I mean, I can hardly be cross with something that happened before we existed, can I? Get in your
So now we take a slow trot and we arrive 2 years later at Haig's next feature, a beautiful piece of cinema starring Charlie Plummer and, well, a horse.
So what do you think about all this, Charlie?
What do you mean?
Yeah, working the backside, being here an asshole or nowhere.
I like working horses.
Plummer stars as Charlie, a teenager who finds work for a horse trainer, played by Steve Buscemi, and befriends the fading racehorse Lean on Pete. Travis Fimmel plays his very neglectful father, and Chloe Sevigny plays Bonnie, a mother-like figure who befriends Charlie. But the horse is the star, as we'll discover. I spoke to Charlie Plummer.
Why did you want to play the role of Charlie Thompson in the film?
I connected so much with the script and the story, and I think the character was the inroads to that. As soon as probably finished reading the first scene, I really just connected so much with him, and I think that's really a credit to Andrew, who wrote the script, and Willie, who wrote the book, for just writing a character who I think is a complex one, but is also a really truthful one. And I always commend, you know, anyone who can do that for someone who's 15 or younger, because I think that's challenging, you know. So I think right away I connected with that, and then as soon as I finished the script, I just felt so hard for the story and just the journey that that character goes on and who he is by the end of the film. And so it was a real no-brainer for me to push as hard as I could to make it happen.
You even wrote letters to Andrew.
I wrote a letter because I had sent in an audition tape, and then I think it was the weekend. And so I was so anxious because I wanted it so badly. So the weekend I was like, what can I do? So I wrote this letter just detailing how much I loved it, but also how much I connected with the story and with the character's journey and why. And yeah, and then I got another request to do an audition. And then right after that, I found out I got it. So, I mean, Andrew says it wasn't entirely the letter, but I think the letter maybe helped a little bit. But yeah.
You talked about connecting to the character. Could you talk maybe broadly what you saw in it? I mean, he's obviously very lonely, very internalized, I suppose.
Yeah, I think, you know, growing up, I was always pretty internalized. I think I was always a listener. But I mean, more to the point, I think, you know, him moving around a lot directly applied to my growing up experience. And I think also he's such a compassionate person. He's a sensitive person, even though he doesn't speak very much. You know, you can see it, and I think I could read it from just the script alone, which were all things that I really connected with. And especially his journey to find home was one that I really related to.
Not being an actor, when you are faced with a story like this where a lot of it were kind of reading the expressions on your face, how hard is that to kind of convey what was on the script or what Andrew wanted to the camera?
I think for me, like, that's just always the kind of acting I've always really responded to. And so growing up watching films, those are the ones that really hit home for me. And because I think, like, whenever I'm in just real life and I'm watching someone and they don't know I'm watching them, without sounding too creepy, you know, I think that that's usually what I see. It's a very internal thing. And so I think for Andrew, I think, you know, just watching his other films, it's very similar the way he likes to make films and the way that I like to make films and the films that I like. So, and I think internalizing the script, I mean, what's great about the way that he shoots is he really doesn't talk too much about it, and he really just tries it. And it's always, you know, a collaboration of, if he does have an opinion or input whatsoever, he'll come in, you know, very briefly and discuss it. But he really gives the actors the space to just be able to try things and experiment with things. And I think he was really trusting of us as actors, especially me, you know, because of how much I'm in the film, and also just based on my age. A lot of directors, I think, would be hesitant to trust an actor so much, but he really did, which I was so happy about.
See that, Bob? This kid's a natural.
Yeah, he's a good kid.
And he ain't afraid of a hard day's work like some of these other kids.
Could you talk about working with some of the other cast? Maybe start with Steve Buscemi, who you've worked with before.
Yeah, I was so pleased to hear that he was going to be doing it. And he's such a great person, and he's such a generous person, and especially to other people. He's so generous with his time and also generous just with his, you know, decades of knowledge at this point. And he also really has, from the day I met him when I was probably 12 years old, he's always really treated me as a contemporary. And I think with him, he just always treated me as just an equal and someone that when we'd have a conversation, it was never an advice session. It was really a conversation about filmmaking. And, you know, we'd have a conversation about our favorite directors, and he'll have probably worked with them. But still, you know, when I would ask him questions, it never came from a place of negativity or anything like that. It really did come from a place of passion. And that, too, is just so positive for me to be around.
His character of Del is the first person who really gives Charlie a chance, though, it's, you know, still has problems of his own.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that that's something interesting about the film in general. I really loved about the script as soon as I read it, and I'm really happy with, because I think it comes through in the film itself, is that each character is complicated and each character has sides to them that are really positive. And of course, at first with Del, you know, he's so appealing to Charlie, the character Charlie, and his friendship is so appealing and his mentorship is so appealing. And over time that is twisted and turned and darkened. And then by the end, you know, of course, Charlie needs to get away from him. And so I think that unfortunately throughout the story, that happens with pretty much every central character that Charlie comes to meet. But I think that can be, that's pretty truthful about life. You know, when those relationships end, many times they start off for good reasons and then they'll end for bad. But, you know, I think that commonly happens. And I just felt when I read the script, I thought that was such a truthful interpretation of just human connection in general.
And Chloe Sevigny as Bonnie, Charlie's looking lots of times for mother figure and even from father figure to a certain extent, but she does go some way to fill that role.
Absolutely. And that was, again, you know, there's only so much she can do, I think. And that's the heartbreaking part, is that in an ideal world, I think for Charlie, he could live with Del and Bonnie and have an odd family, but one that is still a family and one that cares for him and one that protects him. And I think slowly that image and that idea, that dream, it begins to fade. And as he's struck with reality and the reality of their lives and the reality of what they have to do to survive, he realizes that's not going to fly with the way that he would like to live his life. That's why he has to move on.
I think every character is complicated. Charlie's father is, he has a lot of faults, doesn't he? I mean, how did you view him?
I mean, I think I viewed him, and we spoke with Andrew and Travis, who played him so well. I think we spoke that they were more or less a lot like brothers in a sense. And so when it's your father, it's he'd probably be a pretty disappointing father. But if it were your brother, that might not be the case. Therefore, I think Charlie gives him a lot of breaks. And I think in a lot of ways, Charlie is the mature one, is the one who's responsible and the one who gets a job and is actually making money and the one who is safe and takes care of themselves. And his father is the one who's messing up and doing all these awful things. And I think that leads to, you know, an unfortunate series of events. But I think that was always kind of the key for it. This is a good guy. And I think he loves Charlie and he wants to be a good guy and he wants to be there for him. Just like a lot of, you know, and I'm an older brother. And I think at the same time, he doesn't necessarily feel like his dad as much as he would like to.
I'm sorry. I didn't do anything to the toy like that. Hey, I'm gonna be fine. You should go home, get some sleep.
No. You stay right here, okay?
I'm not gonna be much company.
It's okay.
Let's move on to the star of the film, other than yourself, Lean on Pete. Or Pete. What was it like working with a horse?
Yeah, it was wonderful. I mean, I had such a good time. It was nerve-wracking at first. And I think whenever you start working with a huge animal like that, that could kick you in the face or, you know, step on your foot and break it. It can be nerve-wracking. And I think for me too, as an actor, it was a great test because the trainers who were so incredible and helpful, they really said to me, like, you have to day one be really confident with the horse, because if the horse senses that you're nervous or it can take advantage of you, push you around, then it will. And it will remember that, because horses' memories are so vivid and clear. And yeah, and they're also emotionally so intelligent. And so for me, I think just from the get-go, it was a little bit nerve-wracking. But as soon as I gained that confidence, it became such a dream, because, you know, horses are such beautiful, kind animals, and I love animals. And I think getting to work intimately with one and getting to have a scene partner that, you know, has these beautiful, huge eyes and is so expressive and decides to do what he wants when he wants for a lot of the time. And it's a lot of fun. You know, it can be difficult at times, but honestly, the trainers that he had were so great. Their names were Lauren and Roland, and they were so, so talented. And
one of the touching things for me was the fact that Charlie wouldn't ride Pete. I thought that was kind of some kind of real deep respect there.
Yeah, and I think that of course, I think it starts because Charlie is being respectful of his job, et cetera. But then I think when he, as soon as he really decides that this is my creature and I'm basically going to give my life to this creature, he treats it as, you know, as anyone. And I think that I compare this film to an untraditional love story, because I think it really is. And I think that Charlie really relies on Pete in a time of hardship and grief and tragedy. And, you know, I think he really falls in love with the horse, and not in a romantic way, but in a real, in a truthful way. And that he wants to respect the creature, and he's protective over the creature as if, you know, it were a sibling or a family member or a partner or whatever that may be, because I think that that love really is genuine. And so I think that that's why, you know, especially towards the end, he becomes so attached to the horse that he doesn't want to disrespect him at all.
He tells him things he's never told anyone else before.
Yeah, and he really, and it's quite heartbreaking, because I think he, as a person, as a young person especially, hasn't ever had the opportunity to share those things with anyone, hasn't had the time to, not only because his father is doing whatever, but also because, you know, these people that are important to him leave his life and don't come back. And I think that he, you know, Pete represents someone who is there for him in a way. And is there unconditionally and will be there and to listen when, you know, I think Charlie, the character, does such a great job at listening. So to have someone who just does listen purely, you know, is very valuable for him. It's hard for me to watch, especially towards the end. It's really difficult for me to watch, because the line, I think, began to blur as it went on. And especially towards the end, it's really, you know, the emotional feeling that the character was having was really what was going on with me. So it is a little freaky, because I think that it's like watching yourself. Like, you know, the mask has been ripped away towards the end for me. And so I grew up as a very shy kid, and I think acting gave me a way to be able to express all these things with a little bit of a barrier, a little bit of that mask. So I think it's a little bit, it is really terrifying to watch towards the end, when I really feel like there really isn't any there.
Here you go, keep moving, keep moving. Stay ahead of him. After me.
He's singing a song?
Every bit as nice as he seems. Thanks to Charlie for speaking to us. As you may have gathered, Andrew Haig's films are deep and sorrowful, but always with a positive story to tell. I'm Ben Eshmade. You've been listening to an archive edition of Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast, here to inspire more people to discover and love the arts, with weekly episodes of Archive Finds and Themes series. Subscribe to Nothing Concrete on Acast, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you can, leave us a review to help us get the word out.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.